Welcome to the Gay Buddhist Forum, where teachers from all schools of Buddhism offer their perspectives on the Dharma and its application in modern times, especially for LGBTQI audiences. These talks are offered freely to the world and made possible by appreciative listeners. If you would like to support our efforts to share the Dharma with underserved audiences, please visit gaybuddhist.org. There you can donate, find a list of upcoming speakers, or enjoy many hundreds of these recorded talks dating back to 1996.
It's our custom to introduce ourselves before we introduce the speaker. I know we have some students today from Shantideva's class. Welcome, you all. You can say your first name or first and last name as you like. Just go around the room and hear from everybody. I always like to ask people to just take a moment to really listen instead of anticipating and saying your own name nervously. Could you listen to the name before yours? I'm Joe Good.
I'm Marvin.
I'm Kristen.
I'm Claire.
I'm Sean Puka.
I'm John.
Fred.
My name is Wally.
My name is Amos.
My name is Ignacio.
My name is Harley.
MP.
My name is Philip.
My name is Melissa.
My name is Mark.
My name is Eli.
My name is Tasia.
My name is Scott. My name is Cass.
I'm Jeff.
I'm David.
My name is James.
Douglas Hall.
Nick.
Dan.
Peter.
My name is Jerry Jones.
I'm John.
My name is Oswaldo.
My name is Ray.
My name is Tony.
I'm Jim.
My name is Reza.
Jose.
Justin.
Beth.
Gary.
Karina.
My name is Michael.
Paul.
Al.
Ken.
My name is Michael.
Frank Jernigan.
My name is Doug Van Kars.
My name is Roy.
My name is Tage.
I'm Andreas.
I'm Andy.
Do we miss anybody? Welcome, everyone. So nice to see so many Easter bunnies today. Our speaker today is David Lewis, who's a member of our Sangha. Has been a member of this Sangha for 3 or 4 years. He has studied the Dharma for 35 years, first in the Vajrayana tradition and more recently in the Vipassana Theravada tradition. He is currently enrolled in the Spirit Rock Meditation Center's dedicated practitioners program. David.
Thank you. That's an old bio. You can add 5 years to all of that. So I'm really pleased to be here this morning. And to, I thought it was going to be a sparse crowd. I was wrong. Happy Easter, everybody. For a month, I've been thinking about what to talk about this morning. A month ago, I got home from a meditation retreat I was on. I was in silent meditation for the whole month of February. So I've been back in the world for about a month now. And one of the things I pondered is, okay, Easter, how do I connect Easter, Jesus and Buddha? And I just can't do it. It's just too much of a stretch. Except what kept coming back to me is what a great Dharma teacher Jesus was. And when I say Dharma, for those of you that are new to Dharma, that it has several meanings in Buddhism. But one is one meaning is the teachings that the Buddha gave us. The Buddha was a little bit more fortunate than Jesus in that he did not get crucified for his radicalism. Christ did. Buddha went on to teach for 40 years after he gained enlightenment, and most of those teachings are fairly well preserved. So there's a huge amount of material there. But Jesus' teachings, when I was a kid, when I was young, I don't know if they still have this, but they used to have Bibles that Jesus' actual words were outlined or underlined in red. And it wasn't very much of the Bible. It wasn't a huge chunk of the Bible. So we don't have nearly as much, as many words, as much information from Jesus as we have from Buddha. But what it is, from what I know of it, and I studied comparative religions in school, is pretty good Dharma. So Dharma in Buddhism is both the teachings of Jesus or the Buddha or Muhammad, but it's also a word that describes the nature of reality, the way things are, the universal laws. Evolution, the law of evolution is good Dharma. The night sky, the universe that we see when we look into the night sky at night is Dharma. So Dharma has various different meanings in Buddhism, but those are the kind of the two main ones. It's often said in Buddhism that there are two wings to the Dharma. And in this sense, we're talking about the Buddha's teachings, but there's two wings to the Dharma, compassion and wisdom. One wing is compassion, the other wing is wisdom. The great Zen teacher, Thich Nhat Hanh, has added that the body of that bird is mindfulness. So that's what I kind of want to focus on a bit today, is mindfulness. It's a very important practice, not an idea, it's a practice in Buddhism. Mindfulness is what we try to do when we meditate. The act of meditation is applied mindfulness. We take our attention as if it was a spotlight, a beam of a spotlight, and we focus it on something. It might be our breath, might be our body, might be sounds, might be a mantra. And we try to stay mindful of that focus. Sometimes it's called an anchor, like a ship's anchor, holding us in place, holding us in the present moment. We try to keep the spotlight of our attention on the present moment for whatever period of time we're meditating. And that's mindfulness. That's being mindful of our breath or our body or our mantra for as long as we can hold our attention. So mindfulness in Buddhism is the way that the Buddha taught us to experience reality. And it's different than thinking. It's radical. It's a radically different way of experiencing reality and of learning, of gaining knowledge. Mindfulness comes up in all the most important lists in Buddhism. And those of you that have been around here for a while know that Buddhism is full of lists. That's because it was an oral tradition. So that's how the monks helped remember things before they were written down. Mindfulness is the third of the five faculties and powers that we need to awaken. It's the seventh factor in the Eightfold Path, the Noble Eightfold Path. It's number seven. And it's the first, the number one, of the seven awakening factors. If we want to awaken, we have to start with mindfulness. So in Buddha's time, there were, as in our time, there were three approaches to knowledge, to acquiring knowledge. One was the oral tradition, and that today might be, since we don't have an oral tradition so much anymore, that would be books and libraries and universities and teachers. The second was logical reasoning, which we also share. Philosophical reasoning, discursive thought, figuring things out. Sitting in a classroom, learning, deciding whether we agree, whether we don't agree, thinking about it, making a choice. And the third approach to knowledge that was common in the Buddha's time was direct experience. It's much less common. Later in European philosophy, this became called phenomenology. So it was the third of these three that the Buddha chose to emphasize for learning reality. As we all know, in our own rationality, we make mistakes. We get things wrong. We learn something that we thought was right, and we decide later was not quite right. Likewise, we can't really rely on our teachers. Sometimes they're right, sometimes they're not right. Sometimes people that are most confident in their views and opinions and teachings don't have the slightest idea what they're talking about. I wanted to give you an example, but it'd be too dangerous. So the Buddha said the only way that we can truly be grounded in reality, the only way we can stay in the present moment, which is where reality exists, because the past is memory, and that's not real. It's changeable, right? The future is fantasy planning. That doesn't exist either. So the only place we find reality is in this present moment. And the only way we can experience this present moment truly, the here and now, is through our five senses. And actually, I'm really going to throw you now, because the Buddha, unlike our Western tradition, the Buddha added a sixth sense. There is a sixth sense, and that's the mind. So it's not the thinking mind. It's the mind that produces thoughts, and those thoughts we're encouraged to not take any more seriously than a sound, a random sound. The thoughts that arise in our minds should be treated just like random sounds. So if we want to ground ourselves in reality, if we truly want to experience reality, and if we truly want to live in the here and now, it has to be through the direct experience of our five senses, plus not taking thoughts too seriously. So given that, you're kind of wasting your time listening to me. The learning experience of what you've done this morning, you've already done. You did in meditation when you were having direct experience of whatever you were having direct experience of, your breath, your body. Maybe you were noticing thoughts arise and pass away. If you were hopping onto those thoughts and feeding them, then you weren't meditating. But if thoughts were just arising and passing and arising and passing, then that's the idea of the sixth sense of thoughts. Thoughts arise, could be, arise and pass, pleasant ones, unpleasant ones. But the real learning experience from the point of view of mindfulness that you did this morning, the value that you got this day, was what happened when you were meditating for that 30 minutes. In the Zen tradition, they say that the teacher, the guy sitting up front or the woman sitting up front, is just the finger pointing at the moon. And that it's preferable to experience the moon yourself, to see the moon and let it imbue your being. But what we tend to do, especially in the West, is we get kind of obsessed with the finger. We say, oh, you know, I like that teacher, I don't like that other teacher, or they like certain teachings, and this tradition, I prefer to that tradition. We're not experienced based in the way we understand things. So mindfulness is a different way of knowing. It's a different way of learning. And it's not our common habit. It's not the way we're trained in the West. So it takes a certain amount of work, and that work is the meditation practice. It takes a certain amount of work to learn to perceive reality in this new way through direct experience. So I know many of you are experienced meditators, and I also know we have some new people today, so bear with me. I'm going to do a very brief exercise for less than a minute to demonstrate mindfulness, how it works. So put your hand up like this. Doesn't matter which way it's facing, but pay attention to it. Feel the muscles in your arm holding up your hand. And take a look at your hand. Get it visually. Get it the body experience of having a hand. Now move it very slowly, backward or forward. It doesn't matter. And then after it moves about 6 inches, move it back. Paying attention to it. Can you feel the air displaced? Do you notice anything visually changing? Can you feel tingling in your hand? Is there any physical sense there? Okay, that's it. You can put your hand down. Did anybody have a neurotic thought while they were doing that? Did anybody worry, plan, obsess? Yep, one happens. But most people not, right? That was a mindful practice. We were mindful of our hand. And when we're truly mindful, for as long as we can keep it up, as long as we can keep being mindful, it displaces our habitual thought patterns. So what we learn when we meditate, and probably everybody noticed this morning, either in the hand exercise, which even you could still have a thought doing that, stuff can still come up, as it did for a few of you. But when we sit for 30 minutes, it happens a lot. Our thoughts interrupt. We have thoughts come in. We get carried away. We get our whatever is catching our attention today takes us away from our meditation. So this is hard to do. It's really hard to stay focused on an object, a chosen object. And this can be any of those things that we use to anchor attention. It could be our breath. It could be a mantra. It could be, this is the body. We're using the body. This is just a focus of attention, focus for meditation. So the hand is just an example. It could be any number of things. But we just learned that it's hard to stick with that. It doesn't come natural. It's being in the moment, keeping our attention on a physical sensation in the moment is not a natural thing for most of us. So it takes some practice. And that's what that's why meditation is called practice. The Buddha, Buddhism didn't exist until the British named it in the 19th century. That's not to say the Buddha didn't exist and that he had millions of followers over the years, but the word Buddhism was invented by the British colonialists. Buddhism was a practice. It was a path. People said, I'm on the path, or I follow the path, or I follow Buddha's path, or I do this practice. It's something you do. It's not a dogma. So the Buddha gave a famous teaching to the Kalamas, and it's probably been mentioned here before because Westerners really love this teaching, as do I. But the Kalamas were a community or group of people. I can't remember if they were a clan or a village, but the Buddha showed up and he was speaking to the Kalamas, and they were kind of rolling their eyes at him and said, well, okay, you're about the sixth teacher that's come through this week, and everybody's got a different message. Everybody has something different to say. Why should we believe you? You know, convince us. And the Buddha said, gave a surprising answer. He said, you shouldn't believe me. He said, you should listen to yourselves. Two very famous Pali words, which sometimes Pali was the language of the Buddha's time, and a lot of people know these words, are ehi pasako, which means come and see for yourself. He's basically saying, decide for yourselves. And here's what the Buddha said to the Kalamas about what they should not pay attention to in terms of learning, in terms of understanding. He said, do not go upon what has been acquired by repeated hearing, nor upon tradition, nor upon rumor. Do not go upon what is in the scripture, nor upon surmise, nor upon axiom, nor upon specious reasoning. Don't even use your reasoning. Nor a bias toward notion that has been pondered over, nor upon another seeming ability, nor upon the idea that a monk is our teacher. In other words, don't believe your teacher. He said, Kalamas, when you yourselves know these things are good, these things are not blamable, these things are praised by the wise, undertaken and observed, these things lead to benefit and happiness, then enter upon and abide in them. So the Buddha is saying there, use your direct experience. And not in the list. This is not reasoning, not pondering. It says use your direct experience. The Kalamas teaching, the Sutta of Kalamas, is famous for its encouragement of free inquiry. And this is a quote not from the Buddha, but from a commentary. The spirit of the sutta signifies a teaching that is exempt from fanaticism, bigotry, dogmatism, and intolerance. The Buddha said, it was basically saying, in this tradition, there is no dogma. Decide for yourself. Do this. That's why Buddhists don't make very good cults. So there's another list of three, and these are the three levels of knowing something. Not the three levels of learning that I mentioned before, but the three levels of knowing something, how to know something. And the first is reading about it or hearing a talk. That's the first way that we get something. It's like it's what you're doing right now. You're hearing some information and you're maybe processing it and deciding whether this seems to make sense for you or not. The second level that the Buddha taught, it's the way we learn something, is through practicing it. Actually working with that, making a practice out of it. And the third level is actually embodying it, becoming that. So you can take an important concept like impermanence. We all know that the Buddha said that one of the fabrics of existence is impermanence. Everything's impermanent. We can think about that and hear somebody say it and say, oh, that makes sense to me. Maybe everything's impermanent. But it's pretty hard to live it because we still want permanent relationships and we want our dog to live forever and we want our favorite food to be around and we don't want to get thrown out of our apartment, and we don't want to die, and we don't want to lose our loved ones. So we might agree that everything's impermanent, but we resist that. So practicing with it is a whole other thing. Practicing is about letting go of things when they change instead of grasping on. Grasping, of course, being the second noble truth and the source of suffering. Grasping on to that which is impermanent causes suffering. So kind of the point of this whole mindfulness business is freeing ourselves from suffering. And then the third level is embodying it. Embodying it is actually saying, okay, I get impermanence. I've practiced with it. I understand it. It's the way I view the world. It's my reality. So mindfulness is, one definition of mindfulness can be paying attention to the present moment, whatever's going on, non-judgmentally. And the non-judgmental part, well, paying attention part, we've always already learned, is not so easy, holding our attention there. But the non-judgmental part's kind of difficult too, because we have preferences. We like this, we don't like that, we want more of what we like, we want less of what we don't like. So can we pay attention to our experience non-judgmentally? So there's another sutta that I'm really fond of, that where in the Kalama Sutta that I just read you some quotes from, that's where the Buddha tells you what not to pay attention to, what not to rely on for knowledge. And there's another sutta called the Bahiya Sutta where the Buddha tells us what to pay attention to, what we should rest our attention on. And keep in mind, I've already given you a clue. It's the direct experience of your six senses. In the Bahiya Sutta, a yogi, a guy that has been doing his own meditation, his own spiritual practice, but was not a follower of the Buddha, came to the Buddha, went to a great deal of trouble to find the Buddha, basically chased him halfway across India, and asked to be taught, asked for his teaching. And to make a long story short, the Buddha was kind of busy that day and said, no, I can't. But Bahiya kept coming back and asking him. And there's, for some reason, there's a legend in this tradition that if you ask three times, the Buddha cannot say no. So the Bahiya had to ask three times. And so the Buddha gave his teaching. And I think it's the most pithy, direct, short, Zen-like distillation of all the teachings of how to be mindful, how to be in the present moment, how to understand reality that the Buddha ever gave. And here's what the Buddha said. Then Bahia, you should train yourself thus. So it's a training. This is how you train. In reference to the seen, there will only be the seen. In reference to the heard, only the heard. In reference to the sensed, only the sensed. In reference to the cognized, only the cognized. That is how you should train yourself. When you are there, you will only be seen in the reference to the seen. Only the heard in reference to the heard. Only the sensed in reference to the sensed. Only the cognized in reference to the cognized. Then Bahia, there is no you in connection with that. There is no you. There is no you there. When there is no you there, you are neither here nor yonder nor between the two. Just this is the end of stress. So that brings in the idea of anatta, which is a kind of more complicated idea, but it's the idea of self. It's what the Buddha is saying is when you're directly experiencing reality through your senses, there's no you there. The ear is hearing, the eye is seeing, the nose is smelling. It's simply sounds meeting the ear. And anything added to that, any thought or interpretation or liking or not liking, that's you. That's you doing something. But the Buddha is saying, try to take the you out of it and just let a sound meet your ear. So I invite you to try doing that when you meditate, just on your own. See if you could just let sounds be sounds, smells be smells, without a lot of interpretation, without a lot of thought. This is how, the Buddha is saying, this is how the mind is trainable. This is how we can train ourselves to be free of our own neuroses, our own habits of mind, through direct experience. Not by thinking about things, by seeing things clearly as they are. So mindfulness practice, when we think about it this way, isn't about getting something. It's not about achieving something. And very often that's what we do when we come to Sangha on a Sunday morning, or when we go on a retreat, or when we listen to a speaker, in the back of our mind we're thinking, I'm going to get something. I'm going to learn something here that will be useful to me. But what the Buddha is saying is that if we're just paying attention to our direct experience, it's about letting go. It's about letting go of the thought process, letting go of our evaluations, and just seeing reality for what it is in the moment. So it's not such an easy thing to do. It really takes some practice, and it helps to have some instruction to do that, to remind ourselves. But every moment of mindfulness, every moment that you meditate, conditions the next moment of mindfulness. In other words, it gets better. Or it gets easier the more you practice. The other wonderful thing about mindfulness as a practice is that it deconditions greed, hatred, and delusion in our lives, the great obstacles to awakening. Mindfulness deconditions greed, hatred, and delusion, and it conditions love, joy, and equanimity at the same time. It's hard to put into words because, again, this is an experiential thing, and those of you that have meditation practice probably have a much better understanding of what I'm talking about than I'm able to express in words. So, as Buddha said in his talk to the Kalamas, he said, don't listen to me. He said, give it a try. Give it a try on your own. Another quote from the Buddha. Develop a mind that is vast like the water, for experiences both pleasant and unpleasant can appear and disappear without conflict, struggle, or harm. Rest in a mind that is like water. So I'd really like to have a little discussion around this, especially since Shantanu's class is here, and we can also change the we can talk about anything you want to talk about. We can talk about Buddhism and the contemporary world, which is the subject of Shantanu's class. I just want to offer that this idea of mindfulness practice or meditation is the classic example of Buddhism in the contemporary world. In Buddha's time, the Buddha taught everybody. He taught lay people, he taught monks, people joined him and followed him, but he also walked into communities that where people would never see him again. And he gave teachings, and those teachings were geared for whoever he happened to be talking to. And he taught everybody meditation. This was 2,600 years ago. And over the centuries, meditation became more of a practice that just the monks and the nuns did, that the monastic community did. And like in all other religions, including Christianity, Islam, Buddhism became, for a lot of lay people, became about a religion of rituals and practices and going to church on Sunday morning, and but not necessarily meditating. So one of the really interesting things about Buddhism as it's come to the West is that for the first time since a few hundred years after the Buddha lived, since the Buddha's time, lay people are interested in meditating. So what we're doing here is pretty interesting and unique compared with what Buddhism is in Asia. So that's one aspect of Buddhism in the contemporary world, is we are doing the ahipasako. We are finding out for ourselves through meditating. So before opening up to questions and comments and discussion, I just want to end with one more quote from the suttas. And these are actually Buddha's last words. And it's about this subject of finding out for yourself, meaning it's, you know, perhaps the most important message he had to him impart. Ananda was his attendant, his cousin, who was always at his side. And here Buddha is speaking on his deathbed to Ananda. Therefore, Ananda, be islands unto yourself, refuges unto yourselves, seeking no external refuge, with the Dhamma as your island, the Dhamma as your refuge, seeking no other refuge. And how, Ananda, is a bhikkhu is a monk or a meditator, how is a bhikkhu an island unto himself, a refuge unto himself, seeking no external refuge, with the Dhamma as his island, the Dhamma as his refuge, seeking no other refuge? He dwells, contemplating the body in the body, earnestly, clearly, comprehending mindfully. He dwells, contemplating feelings as feelings, mind in the mind, mental objects as mental objects, earnestly, clearly, comprehending, and mindfully. He dwells in direct experience. Those bhikkhus of mine, Ananda, who now or after I am gone, abide as an island unto themselves, as a refuge unto themselves, seeking no other refuge, having the Dhamma as their island and refuge, it is they who will become the highest if they have the desire to learn. So that's my offering this morning. Learning is direct experience and mindfulness. So thank you for your attention, and I'd like to open it up for what you think of this. Questions, comments? Yes?
Instead of looking out there at any teacher or religion or anything, for your own direct experience, how do you know when you're deluding yourself?
Good question. I can only say that in my experience, I have a better idea of deluding myself when I'm dealing with direct experience than when I'm thinking. When I'm thinking and rationalizing and using discursive thought, in my own experience, I'm extremely susceptible to delusion. I can convince myself of almost anything if I really work on it. But if I hear a bird singing in a tree and that sound is reaching my ear, even before I label it as a bird singing in a tree, that's a pretty reliable experience. So direct experience does not lend itself so much to delusion. You can, you know, if you have bad hearing, you might hear a bird and think that it's a fire truck. But chances are, with direct experience, you're less likely to delusion. That's kind of the whole point. Good question.
Sound on not even making up where the sound's coming from or what's emitting the sound or anything, just the sound.
Just the sound. Because as soon as we start labeling that sound and telling a story about it, we move into the world, into the territory of delusion. That's where we start to get, and it's a fascinating thing to me, is to how pure and clear direct experience is, and how quickly we muddy it up. And you know, and then when we get into philosophy and justification and political belief system, it's just, you know, then we're not only in delusion, but we're breeding greed, hatred, and delusion. We're, you know, creating harm in the world. So thank you for that. That's a beautiful question. Yes?
I just wanted to share an experience I had several years ago, and I speak several languages, and I ended up walking through a park and saw a flower that I now know to be a lilac, and at that moment I couldn't remember the name for this flower in any language. And it was both a startling and very joyous experience to just look at the flower and not have access to the language.
Yeah, magical, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a beautiful thing. And also, as you experienced, knowing several languages, it's almost like having several different perspectives on the same reality. So there's great power in language. And just only knowing one language, sometimes we're kind of trapped in a way of thinking about things. Yeah, Jim.
Thank you, as always. Wonderful talk. Gratitude seems to have an extra layer of awareness to it to suggest the presence of someone being grateful. So it doesn't seem to be as direct an experience. Is that a delusion? What is this, the phenomenon there? Do you see what I mean? And if the self that fears and hates doesn't really exist, is the self that feels grateful for the moment, is that also non-existent or less real? You see what I mean?
Well, it's not that those feelings, we can say, and not as a really complicated concept. We could say that there's no self or non-self, but we still have feelings and emotions, and we still have greed, hatred, and delusion, and we still have love, joy, and gratitude. So even the Buddha, after his enlightenment, he still admitted to have all of these things. What he was free of was grasping onto them. And the Buddha, it's a whole other Dharma talk, but the Buddha said that there's great value, and he gave many lessons about how we can avoid giving in to greed, hatred, and illusion, and how we can and should actively encourage gratitude, joy, equanimity, and love. That those are things that he spent a lot of time teaching, teaching us how to feed. So there are certain thoughts and feelings that are to be encouraged. And I almost said that, you know, what I've been talking about is kind of the head and the mind, and what you're talking about is the heart. But in Buddhism, there's no difference between the head and the head and the heart. They're one and the same thing. It's called citta.
Thank you.
Yeah. Either and both. Yeah, Shantanu.
Yes. Thank you. First.
Sure.
You were saying towards the end of your talk that one difference you see between traditional forms of Buddhism and contemporary Buddhism is the active involvement of lay people in meditation. And I just wanted to ask you, what other differences do you see between pre-modern forms of Buddhism and neo-Buddhism, you know, whether in Asia or in the West? What's changed?
Well, that's a big question and a really interesting one. There's a recent book that came out called The Buddhist Religions, plural, religion with an S. And it's a scholarly book. I think it's used as a textbook. And it's got several authors, and they look at how Buddhism changed as it started in India and moved into Tibet and moved south into Ceylon and into Southeast Asia and then Vietnam and China and Japan, and as Buddhism spread. What their speculation is that it actually became different religions, that the Tibetan Buddhism is as different from Zen as almost as Christianity is from Islam. You may or may not agree with that, but it's an interesting theory. So Buddhism has spread and changed and even become different religions, if you buy that theory, in the same way that other schools of thought and other religions are. And now it's come to the West. And one of the advantages we have in the West is that we can look at all these different traditions. We can look at Zen, we can look at Tibetan Vajrayana, we can look at the Theravada traditions of the South, and contrast and compare and try to get at the nub of things. And one of the most interesting movements that really fascinates me that's happening in Buddhism right now is that there's some monastics and some scholars that are using computer models and technology to analyze the suttas, and also the suttas as they were translated into Chinese, to get back at the root of what the Buddha taught, which we've never been able to do before. It's all been conditioned by centuries and centuries and centuries of cultural influence. So there's another movement going on that's kind of related to that called secular Buddhism. And it's people in the West that are kind of treating Buddhism as more of a psychological technique than a religion. Stephen Batchelor is the leading author about that. So there's a lot of really interesting things. Some of the most interesting things happening in Buddhism are happening in the West, in America and in Europe, where Buddhism, where the current bubble of interest is. Buddhism died out in India with the Mongol Islamic invasions, and has only been carried on in peripheral countries. And I heard a teacher recently say that Buddhism is dying out in the countries where it's famous, in Burma and Thailand. And he said there's Buddhism in those traditional countries that have carried on the tradition for over 2,000 years. The two biggest obstacles, the two biggest enemies of the Buddhist tradition are communism and capitalism. And that up until now, we've thought, okay, you know, the communists destroying temples. We all know what's happened in Tibet with the Chinese invasion. Is a great tragedy, but this teacher said, I actually think that the damage of capitalism is much worse. Because, mm-hmm. you know, young boys and girls don't go to monasteries anymore to get their education. They don't get the training. Everybody has got technology. So there's a theory that Buddhism's future is in the West. It's where people are taking an interest in it now. I don't know if that's the direction you were going with that question, but that's kind of what interests me.
Jeff? I went to Tassajara. There was a woman teacher who was very, very eloquent and wise, and I asked her what she saw as the friction points of Buddhism moving to the West. She said three things: feminism, psychology, and patriarchy. And I said, sort of like a Catholic Church. She said, exactly right.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah. Yes?
This may be a little far out question, but as a therapist, you know, I've worked with people with schizophrenia, and the voices they're hearing to them are real. And so far, the biggest solution is to give them medication to quiet the voices. But I'm wondering about meditation in terms of if you've seen how effective that could be with them, help with them learning to disengage from the voices and not allow them to give so much power over their lives.
Well, I'm not a professional, so I'm not a therapist, so that's kind of outside my purview. What I've heard about that mental health and meditation that has interested me is on this question of anatta, where this idea of no self. And people have said, teachers have said, but that doesn't apply where mental health is an issue, because in order to let go of your false sense of self, you need to have a pretty solid sense of self. Does anybody else want to answer that question that has more psychological background or expertise? It's a really interesting question.
Yeah, because there's suffering,
there is suffering.
Meditation is really can be that helpful to them in that situation when the voices are so powerful.
I know meditation is very helpful with common depression, and I know meditation is very helpful with common anxiety. But when you get into schizophrenia and borderline and some of that stuff, that's mm-hmm. not in my job description. Sorry, wish it was.
Okay. Well, do we have one more question?
I have a brief question. You said that part of what's important in meditation is to meditate without an objective. I've been struggling with this dilemma for many years because I know that after I meditate, I'll feel better, and the rest of my day will go better. So I feel like, you know, am I being a bad Buddhist? Is this a dirty little secret? That, you know, part of what motivates me to meditate is knowing that after I'm done it, I feel better.
No, that's okay, because that's your direct experience. You are experiencing a direct experience. The only place where I would say that might be problematic, and this has happened in my own practice, especially when I was on retreats, is when I meditate to feel better, and I don't. And then I feel like I'm a failure, or I had a bad meditation, or
you've been robbed.
Or I've been robbed, or I'm not doing it right. Mm-hmm. But the fact is we all have bad meditations. And that's actually a term that I should not use, because in the practice, any meditation is good meditation. So if you can be kind of sad over some loss in your life, and you can sit with that sadness and have some equanimity around it, that's a way of feeling better. But what you've done is you've acknowledged your sadness and you've sat with it, and you still have that sadness afterwards. That's a beautiful thing. That's a good meditation. So that's actually a beautiful question. I'm glad we ended with that. Thank you.
When you talk about communism destroying Buddhism, since Buddhism, in essence, isn't a religion, it isn't even a rituals or anything like that, it seems like you really can't destroy it. People can be distracted for a while with all of that stuff, but all of the essence of what it is cannot ever really be destroyed.
Well, there are the institutions, and in Tibet there were a lot of monasteries and schools and Buddhist universities, and those institutions have been destroyed. Right. The thing that the teacher that I heard speaking about it was concerned about, and it's what he said capitalism is destroying, is the people's willingness and interest to meditate, mm-hmm. to sit with direct experience. Right. And that's a bigger threat than knocking down the institutions.
But those are all illusions anyway, so eventually you may think the solution is through this ideology or through this. Or through. I mean, people may, ultimately,
yeah.
They're going to have to come back to this ultimate truth,
yeah.
no matter how far they meander off.
Yeah.
Even
yeah.
communism is meandering off, or even capitalism.
Yeah.
You can have so much stuff that eventually you're going, this really isn't bringing me ultimate peace, all this stuff. And so then you go on a further quest. So.
One would hope so.
Or not. I mean,
Thank you.
There's one more burning question.
Okay. Burning question. This is great.
I just came back from almost 4 months in Asia tutoring monks in Dharamsala, Tibetan monks and nuns, and traveling through Myanmar, Cambodia, and Thailand. And I just want to say that whoever said that about Buddhism dying there, it doesn't have the experience that I had, which is that it's quite alive. There's people who are meditating very seriously. Maybe pockets, cultural things have happened. consumerism is taking over. There's certainly the influence of communism in Myanmar and certain sections in Cambodia still. But by and large, you know, don't give up hope. There's a lot of people practicing and a lot of really wonderful people to talk to.
Yeah, thank you. And Myanmar is a good example of where Buddhism is a great force of good in an oppressive
That's also a country. Big story, too, but you know, yeah. It's always a big story.
Yeah, thank you. Beautiful.
Do we have any announcements?
As many of you know, I've been involved with Cuba and trying to make contacts with Cuba. I just wanted to mention that I'm now hosting a cousin of mine finally was able to make it out of here. He will be giving a talk at San Francisco State Wednesday at 5 p.m. He has been involved in preserving Cuba's historical heritage that includes his activities that range from archaeological excavations in the 1200s to the historic restoration of his hometown. So I will be around for anybody who wanted to be the information on exactly when and where, but it will be at 5 p.m. on Wednesday at San Francisco State.
I'm Cass, I'm your host today. Please stay and enjoy the fellowship of the Sangha. I have some treats for your delectation and some hot water for tea. If you have tea, please wash your cup with hot sacred water. And there's a sign-up sheet for getting on the TBF mailing list. So take advantage. In our tradition, you never charge for the Dharma, so I will be coming around with the Dharma bowl. Donations of $5 to $8 are suggested, but to our guests, we understand completely about student budgets. And at 12:30, some people gather by the front door to go for lunch.
And let me also add that at 12 o'clock, the meters kick in outside. So if you have a new Sunday charge for parking, it starts at noon.
Is that in effect for Easter?
Oh, maybe Easter is exempt.
I don't know.
It's always exempt.
I only mention Thanksgiving, Christmas, and New Year's.
Hi, I'm Jack. GPF puts out a newsletter every other month. And it's available on our web online on our website. And then we also send out paper copies. Nearly 400 this time. And at the end of every odd number month, which is today, we mail out, or we prepare for mailing by stamping and labeling and stapling and all that. About two-thirds of us go to prisoners, and a third go to people like us out here in the world. We have a few foreign people, and about two-thirds go to prisoners who really appreciate and depend upon this good contact with the outside world. So I'd like to ask for some commitments, volunteers, maybe at least 8 or 10 people, so we can sort of do this equivalent of a quilting bee to put all this together so we can mail it out and put the word out there. So can I see hands of people who can stay? It's about a half an hour ago.
Announcements.
Oh, Joe, would you have the newsletter for next week?
I don't. This is the end of the old newsletter.
Okay. Thank you. Todd Ormsby is a sociologist who studies both gay male culture and religion and teaches comparative religion in San Jose State. Most recently, he has been researching people who chose to leave Mormonism and transition into some degree of unbelief. His deeper interests are in understanding how and why people change their personal religious practices and beliefs. He's especially curious about what happens to individuals as they make those religious transformations, their emotions, their day-to-day lives, their perceptions of the world, and indeed their very selves. Anyways, should be interesting. That's next week.
Sure.
So offering merit is just an opportunity to take a moment to remember that our practice here this morning, both our silent meditation practice and our discussion and sharing, is beneficial. It's beneficial to ourselves. It's beneficial to everyone that we come into contact with. And that benefit radiates out to the whole community. So may all beings benefit from the power of our practice. May all beings find peace, happiness, and release the suffering. May all beings be well. May all beings have a happy Easter.
Thank you for listening to the Gay Buddhist Forum. If you would like to hear several new talks per month and be notified of upcoming speakers so you can participate live, please subscribe to this podcast, like us on Facebook, and join our mailing list by visiting gaybuddhist.org.